theater director Ron O.J. Parson, Chicago Bear great Doug Plank, and live music in Studio 435 with the Chicago band Laverne. And now, here's your host, a man who is looking forward to a Bears playoff run, Justin Kaufman.
Started yesterday, guys. I've turned around. Last week, I was on my way out. This week, oh, I'm smelling January. A Brian Hoyer January. Good evening, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight here on 720 WGN. It's a download. Woo! It's been a couple days since we've been on. The Blackhawks are back, which is awesome to have them back. They got the Red Wings tomorrow night. But, I get a little lonesome, for Klemp when it comes to missing my Download Nation. 312-981-7200. I had a chance to fill in for Cochran on Friday, so I got to do the other end, the morning, 6 to 10. And I have to say, the biggest difference, I mean, besides, like, everybody's in the room, Pete. So, you know, if you're familiar with our broadcast, everybody's in, you know, Pete's in the booth and Rob's in a booth. But the way Cochran does is Andrea Darlis and Dave Ennett, and sometimes Mary Vandevelde, but she was upstairs. They're all in the room with Cochran. So it's kind of awesome that there's just this play all the time. But it's entirely different. And the other thing which I noticed is that we have a very leisurely Michigan Avenue at night. 7, 8, 9 o'clock. It's usually people hand in hand walking from dinner to the lake or to the river walk and back to their hotel. In the morning, oh my. It's like people are being chased by zombies. They need to get to their building inside and sit at their desk at a certain time. They do not have time for anything but to walk as fast as they possibly can, sometimes trot, to get where they need to get.
Is there a lot of people in the window waving?
No.
They're just all like, they just are, zipping
by. It is
by.
Business. This is mm-hmm. this couldn't be more foreign to them, the idea of it. They do not care. They're not gawking. They don't, they're not like, oh, it's radio. They are, I have to get to my accountant's seat. In 2 minutes, and I've got to carry this huge coffee with me. Like, everyone's got their huge coffee. I mean, I've never seen such big coffees. So that was a takeaway, essentially. And that I was talking to Dan Hampton. I called him Dave Hampton. This is a funny story. I called him Dave Hampton because you saw in the Sun Times last week that Sneed said that Donald Trump called him Dave Hampton when he was in Chicago. And I said, well, it's good having you, Dave. And then Dave Ennett cut me off and he said, prediction, Dan, what do you think? So it just sounded like I screwed up his name. Like, for a second, it just looked like the fill-in host didn't know who Dan Hampton was. So there's this moment where I'm like, I was just trying to make a joke. So then I'm like,
How do you go? Do you go back to
I
it?
I had to go back to it. I didn't want to because we were tight on time. But I'm like, what I meant was, you know, 85 Bears, I know everything.
So get another chance.
Anyway, great show coming up tonight. Glad to be back. Touche coming up after the 7:30 news. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling. Lots to talk about. Lots of scandals. Seems like everything's a scandal. We can't just have any specific conversation about the issues in this election. It comes down to the scandal. Tonight, of course, we'll talk about tax returns, whether they matter to the faithful on either side. And also we'll talk about the big story about the charities. The Trump Foundation told by the New York Attorney General to stop soliciting donations and then also to open their books by October 15th. Not good if there's bad news in that paperwork. It's October 15th, obviously. So that's not good for the Trump campaign. So Chris and Dave will hash it out coming up after 7:30. My guest tonight at the big table, legendary longtime director here in Chicago, Ron O.J. Parson. He's a theater director in town. He's worked for Goodman, Steppenwolf. He's got a new show at the Windy City Playhouse. We'll talk to him about being a life in theater here in Chicago, a prominent African-American director, great, great talent. We'll talk to how he got here and how he sustained a career in Chicago theater. Talk with him coming up at 8 o'clock. 9 o'clock, Doug Plank, breaking down that Bears victory. Like I said, Brian who? Brian Hoy? Brian Hoyer? Super Bowl, Super Hoyer. Come on. Also, it's the worst, we're the worst. Chicago Bears fans are the worst. Yay! New toy! For a week. And then we're like, oh. Chad Hutchinson, anybody? Remember that? Nobody remembers that? Also, Andy Zaltzman's going to be here. UK satirist. the half of the Bugle podcast that he does with John Oliver. That's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Can't wait to talk with him. He's going to be at the House of Blues tomorrow night. And Studio 435 with the Chicago band Laverne. So that's coming up tonight, along with news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. And I'm Justin Kaufman. This here is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right. Take a quick break. Come back. Do the carryout. Stay with us. All right. Let's get this show on the road. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for the carryout. This is, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. The New York Times released Donald Trump's taxes from 1995 over the weekend. And documents suggest that because of the staggering losses, Trump hasn't paid taxes in probably 15 years. This was met with a round of whoos and a round of whoos from supporters. But it's drawn criticism from billionaires like Buffett and Gates, who believe not paying taxes is morally wrong. And now, the Trump Foundation in hot water as the New York Attorney General has shut it down, forcing the charity to open its books by October 15th. Ugh, another scandal. And this scandal clocks in at 83rd on the top 100 scandals of the Trump candidacy. Now, a dedication to a dog. What is this? The dedication to a dog. We'll do it live! Sorry, mixing up my blow-ups. Tomorrow night is the VP debate. Really? Can we just skip it and give time to Alec Baldwin and Kate McKinnon? Or how about Chelsea versus Ivanka? Or Giuliani and Elizabeth Warren? Or even better, Dicka versus Kaepernick? Anything but Pence and Kane. Anything. It's like having the show A-Team following it up with Riptide. Yeah. After the news that Wells Fargo created fraudulent bank and credit card accounts without consumer consent, Alderman Ed Burke is proposing that we eliminate all city business with this bank. This will put the executives out of work, which, you know, they'll be looking for new work, like snow plowing. You know, and Alderman Burke's like, yeah, that's fine. You can do my street first. Then maybe we'll let you be bankers. We're 8 days away from a possible teacher strike, which seems more and more possible every day. Funny, the mayor's planning to deliver his budget address on the same day as the teacher strike. Huh. Not sure on the optics on that one. A speech about how we're spending our money on the day that we had to spend money on childcare because the money we spend on schools is worthless? Also, do we get a tax rebate if our schools aren't open on the 11th? No? I'll bet that's not in the speech. Yesterday, the Bears won. More on that in a minute. But during the game, a fan ran onto the field wearing a gorilla suit and a T-shirt that said, All Lives Matter. Hilariously not funny. We expect this kind of stunt from fans in Kentucky or Tennessee. But here in Chicago... Oh, the dude was from Tennessee? Well, okay. Nice to know it wasn't a Chicagoan being a douchebag racist. We're good. Carry on. Also, maybe high time that security just doesn't let people who wear gorilla suits into the stadium? I know it's kind of like a tradition or a weird warming thing or an ode to Jim Belushi from Trading Places, but I don't know. Maybe something we could lose? Yeah. Moving on. Kim Kardashian was reportedly robbed, bound, and gagged by gunpoint in a Paris hotel room on Saturday night. She said it was the worst moment of her life. I feel terrible about this. I mean, really. I'm glad she's okay. That's super scary. And I'm also super angry at the French scumbag who did this. Not because of the mugging, which is terrible, but mostly because we're going to hear about this for the next 8 months and possibly 6 seasons of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And forget about Kanye. He's going to lock it down. He's going to put those kids in veils. He's going to go super weird Michael Jackson from here on out. So again, thanks, French mugger. I get it. Kim Kardashian's ridiculous. But you know what? She's our ridiculous. Come on, Obama. Come on, Congress. Bring back freedom fries. Boycott. Ugh. In weather, I may have to upgrade my socks to a thicker cotton. Not wool yet. Not yet, but we're getting there. In sports, the Bears got on the board with a win against the Lions. Big plays from Eddie Royal and the Bears D that shut down Matt Stafford. Brian Hoyer played well enough to make the pundits break the hyperbole glass. See the front of the Sun-Times today? Jehu showed a picture of Brian Hoyer. Fox TV's Jimmy Johnson said at the half that we've seen the last snap for Jay Cutler in Chicago. Really? And I'd get giddy about that, trust me. But we Bears fans, we've been here before. And not just once. Like 18 times. Nothing phases us when it comes to Cutler QB talk. He's going to be back. And he's going to play till he's 48. Deal with it. We're so screwed. The Bears now go to Indianapolis next week, hoping to go 2-3. Woohoo! The White Sox finished the season doing what they do best, losing. And after a strange week of speculation, manager Robin Ventura, he gone. Rick Renteria takes over. Robert Ventura, pretty lifeless on the South Side. Yeah, he's a fan favorite from his playing days, but he was so positively awful, even after his team let all of the majors out of the gate this season. So now what? Rick Renteria. He becomes the only Latino manager in baseball, which I guess is good, but can he win? Or will he get comfy for a year and then get unceremoniously dumped for a better manager like the Cubs did? I hope Renteria's first move is to bring back Drake LaRoche. Like, that was the problem. We'd all be like, oh, it wasn't John Danks' fault. Oh. The Cubs, they're third on the list in the sports report tonight with 103 wins. No big deal. And they will sit tight and take some time off waiting for the winner of the Mets-Giants wildcard game. Either way, the first matchup will be a tough one for the Cubs. A five-game series against either the team that knocked them out last year or the team that won the World Series the year before. Both have pitching, although the Mets are seriously banged up. But no matter, the Cubs will beat who they have to beat to win the World Series. It's destiny. They're healthy, rested, experienced, and loose until they lose that first game. Then, you know, all bets off. We're going to tighten up like a prune. A prune's tight? Not sure. Anyway, Friday night, 8:15, game one. The Blackhawks back in business. Doesn't feel right to watch the Hawks out on the ice kicking the crap out of the Blues. I know it's preseason, but it just feels right. Although Nicholas Hjalmarsson suspended for the home opener for an illegal hit. Hawks back at it tomorrow night. Bulls start the preseason tonight against the Bucks. And in WNBA action, the Sky beat the LA Sparks yesterday to force a game four. The Sky need to win as they're down 2-1 in a best-of-five series. And finally tonight, a new study out says that if you want to look and feel more beautiful, stand next to an ugly friend. Yep, that's a real study that somebody paid for. It's digging deep on attractiveness and appearances. Anyway, I think that's a nice segue to plug my new business, Stand Next to Justin. Hey, if you want to look good, I'll stand next to you. That's the carry out for Monday, October 3rd, 2016. Hey, it's supposed to get hot out, which sucks because I just ordered a ton of mini marshmallows for hot cocoa. I guess we'll just have mini marshmallow sandwiches. More to come tonight. Touche. We'll argue about politics, which who doesn't love that, especially on a Monday night? Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy coming up. It's Download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right. Rob Martyr, how are you, my friend?
Oh, man. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. That's right. Here we get ready for Chicago Cubs playoff baseball. That's going to be fun.
It's coming.
Blackhawks, too. Man, this is the time. Tonight, the Bulls start the preseason. A lot going on.
You've got this confluence of all this stuff going on. I mean, I agree with you when I was listening to the takeout. Mm-hmm. It will be interesting. Let's hope the Cubs can win those first few games keep that loose feel. Because you're right. You're absolutely right. Things will tighten up quite a bit if they lose that first two games. Yeah.
He goes to Wrigley Field and he shuts them out, man.
Yeah, Thor comes out and pitches a one-hitter, you know. Yeah.
Where this town's going to go crazy. We're all going to tighten up and it's going to need Joe Madden to be like, it's all cool, guys.
Yeah,
it's
the
cool.
Suicide hotline at 311 is going to be burning off the, you know, off the hook.
I have faith. As a Southsider White Sox fan, I have faith in the Cubs.
Hey, I keep telling you, I'm like you, a White Sox fan, but I would love to see the Cubs win. I really would.
Too. I'm not one of those fans that's like, no. So, you know what? Go Cubs.
Absolutely.
There you go. That was as least of an endorsement.
I tried to be genuine.
All right, go Cubs. All right.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche. You go right, you go
right, you go left. That's right, it's time for Touche. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy in studio. This every Monday night here as we get ready. I mean, can you believe we've been doing this all year, guys?
Well, and now it is indeed starting to get dark outside.
It is. It's a dark and storm. Well, not
it's
stormy.
Amazing to think. I mean, we started, I think, Touche maybe back in the wintertime, like because we were doing it before the primary. So, I mean, this has been a consistent
slog. It started off, we were doing recipes.
Yeah, like, we did recipes.
Right.
Cookies.
And tonight I thought I would talk about Rosh Hashanah.
That's right.
Lashana Tova.
Lashana Tova. Happy New Year to all of my Jewish friends out in our audience. I thought we'd talk about the holiday.
No, not really. Instead, let's talk taxes. The New York Times gets an anonymous tip. They get a tax return from 1995. It could be Marla Maples, which is so crazy. But Dave, we've been talking about tax returns and whether or not he should release his tax returns. This is what he was hiding.
Well, you don't know that. This is one of the many things that he's hiding. Look, I think that the tax return story is really interesting. First of all, there's the, hey, how come I have to pay taxes? Just for the record, Donald Trump says, well, I'm a businessman and this is how business people operate. I'm a businessman. I'm an employer. I'm a job creator.
Yeah.
Guess what? I pay taxes every year.
Yeah.
They're painful, but I do it because it's my obligation and the law. So, look, the fact that Donald Trump didn't pay taxes, that's one thing. The fact that Mr. Super Successful Businessman lost $1 billion in 1 year, that's an enormous
amount of money. Chris, let me ask you this.
One-sixth of what Hillary lost at the Department of State.
Okay, let me ask you this. I've heard this before, the concept that, this is Hillary Clinton has thrown this out saying, this is the loophole. Donald Trump has taken it. He's an insider just like everybody. He's running on an outsider platform, but here he is taking advantage of the same things that America is sick of, billionaires, millionaires, and congressmen, everyone else
everybody
taking
in between.
Advantage of everything, right? So, I mean, is there some truth there when this comes out this
Not
way?
Really, no. I mean, her middle initials are special treatment. I mean, how else does she get through all of these
incredible...
Those are incredible, initials. Those are her middle initials.
Special treatment.
Special treatment. Okay. Hillary, special treatment Clinton. Because I am Hillary, special treatment Clinton. No, I mean, I think the public is inured to this kind of stuff. This means a lot to the punditocracy like us or the real pundits in D.C. or wherever the real pundits hang out. We're kind of real, but... it doesn't really matter to the regular person who already understands that this guy's a billionaire. He made and lost fortunes that they can't even imagine. The Taj Mahal casino in Atlantic City was doomed to failure almost from the night it opened, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is ancient history. Just unfortunately, and I know David wishes it wasn't that way, and he'll do his best to revive it. Just like I wish it wasn't ancient history to people about the cattle futures or the travel office firings or any of the White House indiscretions or any blah, blah, blah. But the fact is people are looking at how bad the economy is today and is Hillary going to make it better or is Trump going to make it better? And I think that's really where folks are going to end up deciding.
Agree?
Of course not. First of all, Mr. How bad the economy is today. Rumor has it that we had the greatest single year income growth for regular people in the last year than in history. So the economy's not so bad, and it's actually doing a lot better.
I'm quoting Hillary Clinton talking about Bernie supporters, who she's now insulted the way she insulted Trump's supporters.
No, nice try. That one is super lame. I listened to what Chris is referring to is there was an audio tape that was revealed over the weekend that showed what Hillary Clinton was saying about Bernie supporters at a fundraiser, and they tried to turn this into another deplorables moment. The problem is that she was just giving a description of these Bernie supporters. And Bernie Sanders, when he was on the Sunday show, said, yeah, she was right. I agree with her. So that didn't quite have the zing that deplorables did. But let me go back to a point that Chris made, because I actually want to agree on one thing. The idea of you lost money, you can take that as a loss carried forward to future years. That's not a loophole. And as a businessman who's taken advantage of that, because guess what? Some years you lose money, some years you make money. It depends what it says on the piece of paper. That's not, I think, the real issue. I don't know how real people are going to how this is going to play itself out in the hinterlands. I do think the issue of him losing $1 billion is a big deal. And what's a bigger deal is that we now have a point of entry to why Donald Trump hasn't been releasing the tax returns. And finally, the media are starting to ask the right question, which is, okay, don't release the ones under audit. Mm-hmm. What about the others in the last 20 years you could release today and not have an issue?
So the media may have stumbled onto, quote, that right question and to use David's parlance, it still hasn't got any interest whatsoever in the 33,000 emails that Hillary destroyed. Now, I'm not scoring debate points, but I think listeners...
You're right, you're not.
Listeners are smart enough to understand that not only are these two of the least popular candidates in history, but they're also two of the most secretive candidates in history.
Hillary's released 38 years of tax returns.
Hillary, that is a drop in the secrecy ocean for Hillary Clinton. She devised the entire homebrew server thing to avoid public disclosure, and one may reasonably infer that was to keep from the public any sense of the Clinton Foundation Department of State overlap. And now we're going to get another view. If David is really interested into looking into what the folks are hiding, we're going to hear from Julian Assange in a day or two from Berlin. And
so glad a good pro-Soviet guy like you, Chris, is holding Julian Assange out as a hero these days.
I haven't said he's a hero.
He's a tool of Putin.
There have been several volumes of Hillary's emails floating around. He obviously has one. And the big question has been, how do you get these things validated? How are you sure that they're Hillary's emails? And I don't know if he is. I don't know what we're going to find.
Of course he's not.
But a lot of folks say they are for real and they're going to be devastating. We'll find out.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, touche here on The Download. We'll come back. We'll take a break. Let's talk about the Donald Trump Foundation, which is having troubles in New York. And we'll also talk, we'll continue to talk about tomorrow's and preview tomorrow night's vice presidential debate.
Excitement.
Yeah.
Noto's available.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
You go right, you go right. Touché
here on The Download, 720 WGN. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling. The polls. Let's get right to the polls. Polls got a big spike after the debate for Hillary Clinton. Does she hold it? Because it seems like now all of the campaigning is either happening in Iowa, Pennsylvania. We'll see a little bit in Florida. Is it just in Carolina? Is that just the idea now? We're just for the rest of this, it's just going to be.
I wish we were on TV because your visuals here that you're throwing out with the hands. It's all about the hands.
So many hands.
To the website, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yes, exactly. Watch us on the internets.
It was very CNN. It was very CNN when I just did.
Yes, exactly. No, I mean, look, I think that after the debate on your show, I had predicted that she was going to pick up about 1.5 to 2 points. But that was before the week of insanity. And I'm not just talking about Chris. I'm not just talking about Chris's insanity that ensued.
I thought Georgia the Jungle had taken over.
You know, the 3 a.m. tweet fest followed by the 5 a.m. tweet fest. You know, the obsession with Miss Universe, Alicia Machado. Because, of course, you can't just alienate women. You have to alienate Latinos. It wasn't just that. It's been amazing. So I'm now guessing that her lead settles like 5 to 6 points in the polls
No. Hold on. You know, I mean, look, I believe that the story of this year, and I've said this before, is the extraordinary closeness of the race, despite all of the craziness of Trump and the duplicity of Clinton. But even now, the LA Times released, and the LA Times poll, which is very significantly methodologically different
flawed
from these other polls. So you say, but actually there's a hell of a lot of thinking behind the methodology of the LA Times poll, has him a week after 5 points up, 47-42.
Really?
Now, the truth is he has slid. Trump has slid in Colorado, and I think he slid in North Carolina.
He was slid winning everywhere.
He was
except
no,
Ohio.
No. He's still in Ohio.
No. I'm sorry. Except Iowa.
He's up in Iowa. He's up in Ohio. But the point here is that there is still dynamism in public opinion, meaning it is not set in stone. It's still bouncing around out there,
which means the debates
are important.
I guess it's amazing to me because I guess what it says is that scandals over and over in the media, they just don't have that much of an effect
on him. Yeah, it's bizarre. And look, we don't know. I agree with Chris that there is dynamism in the electorate. And it seems like what they're saying is, look, I really don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton. And I really don't want to vote for Donald Trump. But this scary, what is Aleppo, I can't name a foreign leader guy?
Despite the Tribune.
Despite the Tribune's weird endorsement. You know, they can't do that either. So I think you're going to, we're not going to know who the winner of this thing is until November 8th and maybe November 9th.
Or after. I agree also with David that Trump went off the rails after that that debate, which we talked about a lot a week ago tonight. He was good in the first 30 minutes, and then he just sort of slid off the table. And then what it showed, unfortunately, in the campaign is that there wasn't a mechanism. There wasn't some sort of, normally by this time, there is a center of gravity, right? Sort of Melania, Kellyanne Conway, and Roger Stone. You know, I mean, just to use names, okay? Two or three people who will say, hey, wait a minute, get it out, you know, go to the gym, work the punching bag, get it out of your system, and then come back in a couple hours because we got to get back to where we were. We were winning all over the place, and now you're hurting us.
He worked the punching bag. And, it's women. That's what he uses. I mean, metaphorically,
that is
not physically. That's not ridiculous.
The actual punching bag for Hillary Clinton has been the women of Bill Clinton.
Oh, please.
That is absolutely clear.
Chris, that
forever.
Is such
and none
a
of
lame
you
comparison.
Care about
it.
It
is
none
a lame comparison. Donald Trump has personally fat-shamed dozens of women. There's
Donald
a story out
Trump
of The Apprentice
the
today that
guy,
this is all he ever does.
He's the first guy in the history of New York to put a woman in charge of a construction company. In
Fat
the city
shamer
of New York,
in chief.
So you say.
No, I don't say. He does. What do you think? What do you think? He's advising the people to watch a porno tape.
David, it's not a I understand it's not a porno tape, though I have not watched it, so I can't tell you for sure.
All right, let's move on.
What about the Trump
tapes?
Foundation? What about the
what
foundation?
Are we
talking
about let's
talk. Let's
program,
you know what?
David?
Let's
we
let's.
Might not get
we only got two
back.
Minutes. We got 2 minutes left. Let's ask about the preview of tomorrow night's debate. The vice president. Okay, so who's got more to lose in this case? I mean, is it Pence or is it Kaine? In the sense that if somebody has a bad performance tomorrow, who's more likely for it to affect?
I'll say, as one of the few people probably on or listening to this program who actually witnessed the Bob Dole Democrat Wars moment, I was in Brooklyn, New York, watching with some friends.
You're old.
All right.
Let me tell you, that did not help Jerry Ford. I know normally the Veep stakes is not determinative of the upstairs outcome, and Ford had his own problem in the debates that year. But that Bob Dole moment was unsettling to the Ford Dole 76 ticket.
Well, didn't I mean Biden and Palin? That was a big one where we saw even Biden and Ryan as well. Like there seems to be there's something that goes in these vice presidential debates that resonate with the populace.
There is, but those types of moments often happen when there's a disparity between the candidates. You've got Mike Pence, yeah, the governor of Indiana. You've got Tim Kaine, the governor of Virginia. These are two solid guys. I don't agree with anything that Mike Pence stands for, but he's a fairly solid guy. Mike Pence or Tim Kaine is a very solid guy. I agree with most of what he stands for. He's a really nice guy. These guys do not expect in a moment of excitement tomorrow night. It's just not going to happen.
Can we just skip it?
Well, no, I don't think we should watch. We should find out what they're choosing to talk about, because these guys are a lot more disciplined, I think. Even Hillary's very disciplined, but they're more disciplined than their, you know, upstairs confreres here. And it'll be interesting to hear where they're bridging to. They're going to answer those questions. They're going to bridge, and then they're going to be making some points. And it'll be very interesting to hear what points they think are important to make.
You will hear Mike Pence give Donald Trump's message better than Donald Trump has ever given Donald Trump's
or
message.
Or ever could.
Or ever could.
In a more thoughtful, more conversational, and I would say more more accessible way. Pence is an extraordinarily accessible guy, and that's part of the secret of his success over there in Indiana. You know, he was a radio talk show host, an attorney, congressperson, governor now. And he is going to do a better job with Trump's message than Trump can ever do.
We'll be right back here next Monday to see how this all shook out. Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, Touche.
And I'll be joining Patty Vasquez tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night
between 11 and 2 a.m.
Set your alarm clocks for 1:30 in the morning.
That's right.
Dave will be on Patty. All right. Good to see you guys.
See ya.
See ya, Justin.
This download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little later in the program, Doug Plank, the former safety for the Chicago Bears, joins us every Monday to talk about the Bears. Finally, we get to talk to Plank about a win yesterday against the Lions. So we'll talk with Doug coming up at 9 o'clock. Also, Andy Zaltzman will be here, one half of the Bugles podcast with John Oliver. So we're excited to talk with him. A great satirist, the UK satirist, who's here at the House of Blues tomorrow night. And also Studio 435, the band Laverne will be jamming out live tonight after 10 o'clock. Well, my guest tonight, the Big Table, is one of my favorites. Ron O.J. Parson is a longtime theater director here in Chicago. He's got a new play at the Windy City Playhouse, the Chicago premiere of Jeff Daniels' Apartment 3A. Apartment 3A is a romantic comedy about the day in the life of the main character, Annie, who deals with a breakup, a bad day at work, and all sorts of other experiences before meeting a neighbor who changes her life, again, all in one day. But you know what? That's not enough for Parson. Nope, he's working on another show, East Texas Hot Links by Eugene Lee. It's going to be at the Writers Theater later in October. He's doing them simultaneously. It's actually a remount of a show that Parson and the Onyx Theater did 20 years ago. Parson is an artistic director at the new Onyx Theater Project and a resident artist at the Court Theater. He's worked everywhere in Chicago. Goodman, Steppenwolf, Black Ensemble Theater, you name it. Parson has worked there, and he's my guest at the Big Table. Ron, good to see you. Thanks
good
for being here.
Good to see you. Good to be here. I love it.
All right. So let's first talk about Apartment 3A.
Yeah,
tell
yeah.
us about what drew you to this. I mean, as a director, you get to choose the projects you work on. What,
well,
what,
you
what
know, else? actually with this one, Amy Rubenstein at the Windy City Playhouse, the hot new theater in town, she sent me a few scripts and to see if I would be interested. And I read the Apartment 3A. And I was intrigued, and I had a couple other people read it and say what they think, that people I trust their opinion. And everybody was like, hey, this is fun. This would be great. And so once I got into it, it was even more fun. You know, romantic comedy, but it has a lot of layers. And me being a Twilight Zone fanatic, I said, wow, this reminds me of Rod Serling, you know, even though it's a quirky kind of thing. But I love that kind of mysterious kind of feel to a play. And so, you know, I said, yeah, this is great. And then I love magic. So I said, I think I can fit some magic tricks in here, some sleight of hand.
Is there, I mean,
like
is
that.
For you as a director, as a theater director, I mean, is there one genre you like more than the other? I mean,
well, yeah,
drama?
I would have to say, I used to didn't think that, but suspense thriller, I like that, you know, and I've done I studied film at college, and I don't know how I got into theater and got away from it, but, you know, that was my thing in film, you know, the suspense and the film noir and that kind of thing. So in the theater, I love to do that, too, to take the audience on a ride. And that's what, you know, this play is, like I say, it's a romantic comedy. It's got a lot of love in it, and a lot of, you know, we all go through those situations in our lives and our work day and, you know. But this one adds another element to it with those kind of mysterious.
Well, let me
things.
Ask. I mean, as a director, I mean, how much do you have to mind the comedy? I mean, when you keep saying romantic comedy, for you, I mean, you really have to get the actors and the stage production
no,
to
yeah,
be
that's
funny.
Yeah, that's a really right? good question. And, you know, good writers can do that. They can mix the humor and the seriousness. Like, I direct a lot of August Wilson plays. And August Wilson plays have a lot of humor. And people say, oh, well, it's funny. It's a comedy. I said, no, it's not a comedy. It's got humor in it because we have humor in our life, even when we're going through, you know, crazy periods and chaotic periods or breakups or love affairs that don't go right and this and that, you still have to laugh. And that's what this play does. You know, she's working in public broadcasting. So, you know, that's stressful in itself. So,
yeah, I know,
you know, and so she's going through all of this at the same time during a fundraising drive. So anybody
I
who's
think
been
the word,
in that,
I think we could thank Jeff Daniels for an actual play about
right.
pledge drives.
Right.
We've been waiting for one of
exactly.
those.
Exactly.
Right?
So that's where they're during a pledge drive during the play. So it has its element of seriousness, but it's funny. It's got both.
Now for you, I mean, as I mentioned in the lead, I mean, you're also doing East Texas Hot Links at the Writers Theater. For you to be able to balance as a director two shows at once, I mean, that's got to be so hard to be able to not only balance just the organization of when rehearsals are, but for you to actually dig deep into the text and to to stage things and to come up with ideas. I mean, are you finding yourself like up at night coming up with ideas for the wrong play?
Well, you know that has happened to me before. In fact, one time years ago, not to get off on a tangent, but I was doing two shows at the same time. One was in St. Louis. And you know, so I would do three days in Chicago, where I'd fly to St. Louis and do 4 days there that week and then fly back and do another 4 days here. And then, you know, so it got kind of crazy. At one time, I was like, which airport am I in? Which city am I in? So it did happen. That was quite a while ago. I was a little younger. So now at least it's in the same city. But, you know, these two plays, they're very different. And the East Texas play, I know the cast so well that and it's the fifth time I've directed the play, because it's one of my favorite plays. It's a great play. And the fact that I'm older now, I can, you know, be a little bit more, find different things in it that I couldn't find before. Yeah, for sure. But directing both of them at the same time was very challenging. We'd be all morning at the Writers, and then I'd take the Metro. Luckily, the Metro is right by the theater. And then I would come back down and get off and then ride right over to the Windy City and do that. So luckily, it's opening Thursday, so I can settle on just one play. But they're both, you know, very enjoyable and entertaining plays. But East Texas, the back to the genre, is more like that suspense kind of thriller thing. So it's great.
Well, East Texas Hot Links will be on stage at the Writers Theater coming up in the end of October. Apartment 3A is opening at the Windy City Playhouse this Thursday, right?
Right.
This Thursday, Windy City Playhouse. Ron, O.J. Parson, my guest in studio. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. I want to get at how you got into theater and get to some of the secrets of how long you've been able to sustain a career here in Chicago. Let's do that. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk with Ron. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my guest at the big table tonight, Ron O.J. Parson, longtime theater director. His show, Apartment 3A, is at the Windy City Playhouse, opens Thursday. He's also doing East Texas Hot Links, which is by Eugene Neal.
Eugene Lee.
Got that right. Eugene Lee, it's at the Writers Theater later in October. It's a 20th anniversary remount from the Onyx Theater, which is a good way to start to talk about your career.
Yeah.
Because you came to Chicago in the mid-90s.
I did.
Talk about how you got here.
It's funny, you know, I'm from Buffalo, New York, and I was living in New York City at the time, you know, trying to make my way as an actor, actually. And things weren't going the way that I felt. You know, I was in college. I was a big man on campus in the theater program at the University of Michigan. I thought, oh, wow, it'll be easy. You go to New York and become a star. And it didn't happen that way. So I went back to Buffalo and got involved in the theater. And a good friend of mine, his name is Stephen McKinley Henderson. He's now a major kind of Broadway guy. He works all over. He suggested Chicago. He just said, you know, he worked here with Bob Falls when Bob was at Wisdom Bridge. And so he told me, you know, I've never lived in Chicago, but it's a great theater town. You should go check it out. So luckily, the way things happen, I had a friend who actually founded Onyx with me. His name is Alfred Wilson. He was the marketing director at the Goodman. And he said, you know, I can get you an audition to a play called I Am a Man. It's written by this guy, Oyamo. I said, Oyamo? I know Oyamo. I knew him from New York. And he said, yeah, well, it's his play, and a guy named Miriam McClinton's director. Anyway, get you an audition. Got an audition. I told my girlfriend at the time, I said, you know, I'm going to Chicago to audition for a play. If I get in it, I'm going to stay. She said, yeah, I'll come with you and this and that. So it's a funny story because I got cast, you know, and I was shocked. And I called her. And I said, hey.
You remember what I said?
Yeah, we're ready. Are you? Can you come? And she said, are you crazy? I can't leave Buffalo. I said, she said, I didn't think you were going to get that, you know. So anyway, I decided to do it anyway, and I moved here. And one thing led to another. Alfred and I started Onyx Theater. And I said, well, we said we didn't really have an infrastructure. We didn't really know what to do. He was at, you know, marketing director at the Goodman. So he's very busy. And I said, well, let's try a play. And I called a friend of mine. His name is Ruben Santiago Hudson. He's a, you know, major player in New York. He directs all over and acts. He's on TV, everything. And he said, East Texas Hot Links, man, you guys should do it. They did it in 92 or something, so it was still fresh. And, man, we did that play, and wow, and it just took off. Well, I think Michael saw it. That's why we're doing it.
Well, the Onyx was short-lived. I mean, it was only like a 4 or 5 year.
Exactly. Man, you know your stuff.
What was it like? What was it like doing theater in Chicago in the mid-90s, early 90s? But I mean, talk about that experience for you coming here from Buffalo.
Well, it was what we call guerrilla theater. You know, we kind of just, in fact, the first time we did East Texas Hot Links, we probably had, you know, $5,000 to $7,000, something like that. Godly figure that we didn't think we could do it, but you know, we got actors. We weren't Equity then, so we didn't have to worry about that. And it was hard, you know. There wasn't, you know, the diversity discussion that's going on now. It really wasn't. There was like black theater. It was like Black Ensemble, Impact, ETA, you know, Chicago Theater Company. So there were kind of well-known theaters. But there wasn't a lot of mixing at the major theaters and things that there is now. So it was difficult to get the support. A lot of the funding money went to the big theaters. It didn't really go to the small theaters. But I tell you, if it wasn't for the Joyce Foundation, we wouldn't have made it. And actually, the Joyce Foundation still supports me at Court Theater. So I'm on a Joyce Foundation grant at Court Theater as a resident artist, and they've been supportive of me throughout my career here in town. So that was one thing that Onyx was able to survive with that.
When you started Onyx, and this would be 94, 95, 96,
mm-hmm.
You talk about the concept of starting your own theater company. You were living in New York City, so you knew theater. What were the differences between doing theater in New York and doing theater here in Chicago?
One thing in Chicago, it was more accessible. New York City was a lot different, a lot of more... I guess red tape for doing things. Beth and I were talking earlier about just the difference in attitude of the artists and the producers. It's more stress and pressure. You know, Chicago, we were able to do it and kind of not, I don't say relax, but we didn't have the same kind of pressure. We could just do it. And if it worked, it worked. If it didn't, it didn't, you know, but we enjoyed doing it. That's why there's so many storefront theaters here. People get out of college and they have a group of people that they've worked with in school and they say, let's start a theater, you know, and it's easier to do here just in that sense, you know, because of the finances and what it costs to rent a storefront,
right,
and things like that. So that way it was more accessible, but you know, it's still hard because, you know, you're trying to get, you know, marketing out there, because marketing is as important as doing the play, you know.
So you got to get butts in seats.
Exactly. And if you don't have the marketing plan, it's not going to work. So that was difficult. And that was why we lasted 5 years. We were all doing other things. Lydia Diamond, who was a founding member, is now a major playwright in the country. And, you know, Marcia Estelle, she's working as a playwright and actress. Alfred, of course, has gone on to become one of the actors in town that works a lot. So, you know, we all did our own thing, and eventually we just got out there. And
let me ask you, we always get kind of bypassed when you talk about theater companies, but what's really important about a theater company is how you all sort of come together, the chemistry in the ensemble, that whether it be a director and a playwright and a designer and a stage director, but an actor, they all come together. What was it about the Onyx Theater Company, the group of actors and theater professionals that you were working with at that time, that drew you guys together?
Wow, that's a great question. Alfred, because I knew him from Flint, Michigan. He was an actor and director, producer at the in Flint, where we did a theater called McCree Theater. So I met him in college, actually, at Michigan, but then we lost touch, and then I ended up getting a job in Flint, and I kind of rekindled a relationship with some of my old buddies. So when he moved here, like, I think in the 80s, and I moved to New York. So we just kind of got back together, and then he had known people from being at the Goodman and being connected in the theater scene. Mm-hmm. So when I got here, we just got some, you know, actors and did some auditioning, and we became like a family really quickly, you know. So it was, we call it an ensemble, but, you know, we were all just getting to know each other. So we just kind of felt together, you know. In fact, what I've done with East Texas is put back the original design team, except for, you know, one person who's gone off to become a major corporate designer. But for the most part, it was just that family atmosphere. Everybody, you know, I talked with Christine Pasquale, our costume designer, how in the first days we were up all night sewing costumes. You know, now she has a staff and they're, you know, they're doing it. But so those things, it's just, it was a family thing. It was a spiritual thing. I just think it was a connection of people, just like in any kind of group, you have a spiritual kind of connection. That's what happened.
Ron O.J. Parsons, my guest tonight at the Big Table. He's a longtime theater director. He's worked at pretty much every theater in Chicago, Goodman, Steppenwolf, Black Ensemble Theater. He is a resident artist at the Court Theater. He's also the artistic director of the new Onyx Theater Project, and his show Apartment 3A is at the Windy City Playhouse, opens on Thursday, and East Texas Hot Links, played by Eugene Lee. I don't know why I get hung up on that. We'll be at the Writers Theater at the end of October. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get the tonight's news. We'll come back and talk about, you know, some of the things in Chicago theater that have changed. We'll talk about how you get butts in seats, getting young people into the theater. We talked a little bit about diversity. A lot of things to talk with Ron O.J. Parson about Chicago theater here on The Download. So stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN Chicago. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the Big Table, Ron O.J. Parson, longtime theater director here in Chicago. 20 years of doing theater, plus, I guess, at this point.
Yeah, like 2021, I guess you'd say. It's wow.
Got a new play he's directing at the Windy City Playhouse. It's Chicago premiere of Jeff Daniels, Apartment 3A. Also directing another show, East Texas Hot Links, by Eugene Lee. It's at the Writers Theater later in October. It's a remount of a show you did, 20 years ago with Onyx.
Yeah, we did it in 95 and 98. And actually in the 98 was the year, was the, we opened, and that week, James Byrd was dragged by a truck in the county where the play takes place. So that's really something, yeah. So we dedicated it to him.
Was it difficult to do a play like that when there's a current event that's so emotionally charged?
Yeah,
like
it was really hard because, you know, some people were saying, you know, is it relevant? Is that kind of thing? Because it's in the 50s. And we were like, yeah, it's still relevant, of course. And then that happened.
Yeah.
So then we, the post-show discussions, we talked about it. And the fact that it was in East Texas where that happened. So, yeah, it's relevant.
You know, let's talk about post-show discussions. I've found that to be, you know, it almost becomes a sit-in for civility when you talk about, like, the way that the media has gone, where it's very divisive.
I
mean, it's hard to actually have a balanced conversation. What's your take on the post-show discussion? Is it imperative to have one after a show?
Well, I guess it depends on the show. I mean, at court, we do them at every preview. So, and it's a different audience out there at the University of Chicago, and the questions are kind of deep, you know? Sometimes you get questions like, you know, how do you remember those lines and all that kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. So I think it depends on the play. I'm curious to see actually with the Windy City Theater, because it's a different audience, what those post-show discussions are like. And, you know, with that open bar, not open bar, but with that bar there, you know, no, I'm just kidding. But, you know, your question, because the plays are a little bit more fun-loving, and so you might get a different thing. At court, like in other theaters, they're kind of deep. Like East Texas probably is going to have some real interesting discussions about what I just said, mm-hmm. about is it relevant, is that what's going on. And you know what's happening? I was talking with my costume designer for another play I'm directing later, Blues for an Alabama Sky at Court Theater, and we were talking about how to compare some of the issues in all of these plays with what's going on today.
Yeah, right.
You know, so being able to now try to find the element or the hook, or so to speak, of what the comparisons are from some of these issues that are still happening in 2016.
I was going to say, I mean,
that's crazy.
That's what's wonderful about the theater,
yeah.
is the ability to really push social issues.
Right.
And that happens all the time.
Right.
But it's amazing to me to see the secular nation notion of the concept that a lot of the issues that playwrights were talking about, whether it be the 40s, 50s, 60s, are still relevant today.
Oh,
I mean,
definitely.
Do you see that as a director? Do you
definitely.
See plays that are they're
no
ripped
doubt.
From the headlines from 20, 50, 20, 30, 40 years ago?
It could be ripped from the headlines in the 30s and something happens today that's the same thing, and you're doing a play that takes place in the 50s, and it's still going on. So that's crazy. Like we were talking recently about the Windy City Apartment 3A. So I guess it's a comedy. But that character is talking about things like AIDS and child molestation and, you know, the war and poverty and rape. And, you know, so all those issues are coming into her character, even in the setting of comedy. So that was the trick of trying to find those elements of where we push the comedy, which, you know, best comedy is not pushed. It's just a situation. But in this play, there's a lot of those, I guess you could call heavy issues that are coming in the midst of her going through what she's going through, having lost her love life has changed. And so she's dealing with that depression and that loneliness and, you know, all these other things coming into to play. So, yeah, it's difficult, but most plays, you can relate. Things, you know,
well, so. I was just thinking in my head about all the plays you have done.
Yeah,
I mean, in your career of 20 years, you're working constantly, nonstop. I mean, from whether you're
Thank
a producer, whether you're a producer or whether you're an artistic director, whether you're a director. I mean, is the role of an artist, a theater artist in Chicago, especially now, to be sort of
Definitely.
I guess an artist that's pushing the social agenda
for me, definitely. I've always felt that way. I've always felt that way that, you know, when we do this, it's such an important thing in this art world. So any kind of thing in art, if I was a painter, I would want to do that at theater. When I act, you know, like when we did Waiting for Godot, which I pronounce it Godot. it was happening during the Ferguson, you know, all of that. So these characters were going through something, and we used African-American actors, and we could not be in the rehearsal room without knowing what's going on and putting it into the play, you know, with those characters. And so it happened, you know, some of the rehearsals were very emotional, and we've had emotional rehearsals with Apartment 3A. And, of course, we're going to have them with East Texas Hot Links. So because I'm an emotional, passionate person, sometimes to a fault, you know, it gets you in trouble when you're too passionate sometimes. And so we find that in rehearsal that we have to take a break sometimes because we're thinking about, especially in East Texas, we've already, in our first couple of days at the table, we were talking about, and since we've been rehearsing, three guys have been shot. Three people have been shot, you know. Not only by the police, but the police shot an off-duty cop, you know, the other day. So you can't help it, you know. So, you know, when you're talking about the characters.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, about emotion. I mean, you said passion, sometimes it can be it can be too much or
that's
get
my
you
own
in trouble.
Personal, that's
but
own
is
my...
that, is that per, I mean, but talk about how that plays out. I mean, as an artist, as a theater artist who leads with sort of putting your emotion on your sleeve and being passionate, how can it get you in trouble?
Well, I think you have to balance it sometimes. You know, you are in a play. You know, it is the art that you're doing. So you just have to balance it in your own life, you know. You know, I personally just feel like when I start a project, actors who have worked with me a lot, they know they're betting on how soon I'm going to start crying, you know, and because it's an emotional thing that we do. Theater is in itself emotional. I have a friend, Oyama, who we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. He told me once that, you know, what we do is different from any other medium, you know, because it's so personal, it's so immediate, and you can't, you know, I always say this, I want people to leave the theater talking about the play that they just saw. If it's discussion, that's one thing. If it's disagreement, especially this play, again, going back to Apartment 3A, there's issues of God. Is God real? Is he here? Is he not here? Now, where would you find that in a light comedy, like you say, where they have this serious issue about God? And what if he comes back? And, you know, so that mixture of the two things is really, that's challenging. But just the other day in rehearsal, one of the characters, he had been doing it. Really, he had been doing it. Hello, guys. Hey.
Passerby's
yeah. Yeah. He had been doing it, in, you know, trying the comedic aspect of it. And I said, you know, look what you're saying. What's happening to you? You know, it's a monologue about losing your mom and seeing her in a dream and, you know, her coming back and talking to you and you doubting the existence of God because of that. That's not funny, you know. And so we found some other elements in that monologue.
Right.
And then in the next scene, though, it goes back to comedy. So that's the thing about these plays and good plays like this that can take you on that roller coaster ride. So as far as what I was saying about, you know, balancing it, you know, you can't get too lost in it because it is a play and it is comedy. So we do want people to laugh, but we also want them to feel, you know, heartfelt about what they heard. And I always say, this is another thing that I always say, that I want people to feel the play as much as hear it and see it. And if that's the case, especially in a place like Windy City, which is so close, you're so close, you're so comfortable that you cannot help feel what these players, these actors are doing. And I worked with deaf actors in Rochester, New York, years ago before I actually moved to Chicago. And they taught me a lot about the body and how, you know, they can express themselves physically. And I think that's kind of what I go for in most of my plays, is it's a well, you know, the experience should be so well-rounded that they're not just seeing or hearing a play, they're feeling it. And that's kind of what I mean about being passionate. If I'm passionate, I think I can get that into my actors, and I think we just feel what we're doing is strong.
Let me ask you, I mean, Chicago, you mentioned Chicago and Onyx Theater was built in 1994 when you mm-hmm. guys became a company. You only stuck right. around for a couple of years. But you right. talked about how, you know, the theater companies all kind of were in their own little buckets. They were in their own little categories.
Right. Yeah.
Has that changed? Has Chicago become more diverse?
I think that's changed. It's become more diverse, but it's also become more theaters are, like, trying to co-produce. You know, say you can't afford certain things and you can get with a company and, you know, co-produce something, or maybe do it at your theater and then do it at that theater. I'm trying to do more of that that kind of aspect. Mm-hmm. And then again, I have to, you know, feel like it's more open to do that, you know, whereas before it was kind of like you say, everybody
yeah, right.
was in their own
silo,
their
right.
world. Yeah. And like I was saying earlier about this project I'm trying to do, I think that's what I'm going to need to do, too, to find theaters that are willing to accept some of these young people that we're trying to get involved in the theater. You know, we're calling it Beyond the Stage, which we're going to try to introduce young people of color to elements of set design, sound design, light design, that kind of thing.
Why are people of color not why are they not into theater?
That is actually a good question, and that's the thing we were talking about earlier, is that a lot of the parents don't want their kids to go into the arts, you know, it's because it's not known for being, you know, very lucrative, or you can't get a lot of work and this and that. And ironically, though, you can in the backstage, you know, in the lighting design, set design, even if it's not theater, there's corporate lighting designers and things like that. So it's just, I guess we want to introduce people to a new outlook on that. The young people, usually it's actors. They want to emulate
yeah,
acting.
Right.
And so basically this program through the Three Arts Foundation, we're trying to get new people, young people, to see the what's available beyond the stage.
Well, I always think about this because there's always been this push and pull with theater companies to be able to get young audiences
right.
in seats. I mean, that's what Windy City Playhouse is trying to do
exactly.
with 3A. That's what others have tried to do. You see this with initiatives. You know, and a lot of the stories that resonate with young people are going to be told through music.
Right.
Or maybe they're told through movies.
Right, exactly.
Why do you think, as a longtime theater director, that you're not able to get younger people to sink their teeth into the stage?
Well, I think it was, you know, a lot of it was the non-diversity. You know, the fact that there weren't plays or people they could see that they could relate to. In fact, a friend of mine told me, you know, I was trying to get him to come see The Mountaintop, which is a show I directed a few years ago about Martin Luther King and this angel that comes to his room. And he had come to other plays of mine. He was like, man, I don't see that old stuff. I don't see that, you know, the old-timey you know, stuff. And so he came to see that, which was a kind of a combination. But the elements, the technical elements on it, because people are, young people are so into social media, you know, for one thing. So everything's,
right.
Everything's on their phone, this and that. So this play had a little bit of that element in it, you know, with some video and things like that. And he loved it. So I think it's people, they, the young people, some of them have a perception of theater that is just not something that they, you know, think about going.
But
to
you
do.
Have situations like the breakthrough hit with Hamilton,
exactly.
where you're seeing much more of a crossover. I mean, is that what it takes? Is for shows that resonate at that level, at Broadway level, or does it take the stories that are being told on even storefront theater stages to be more representative?
You hit the nail on the head. That's exactly it. Like I was saying at court when I first did. I did Wait Until Dark. And now that's a play that it doesn't say what race people are. It's in Greenwich Village in 1965. Now, I was in Greenwich Village as a kid in the 60s. You know, I'm that old. You know, I was a little kid. And you did see different things. You saw different people. And so why not? You know, we had, you know, the actress who played... the lead blind woman, if anybody knows that play, was Filipino, Mjoy Gavino. And I actually saw in the audience some Filipino audience members. And I said, "How? You know, why did you come?" It was because of her, because we saw her. And we knew she was in the play. Hmm. And that carried over into other things and other places. Now, we have a lot of programs with schools, with high schools and things, like, which is how I got involved in theater. With them coming to my school. And so we do a lot of that, and I think that that's happening. I'm also a company member at Timeline. I haven't talked about that. But we have a
great theater company.
Well, we have an active living history program that goes into the schools and gets these young people to read the plays. Core theater, too, we all. And I think that's a big thing that the younger theaters, storefronts, and everybody is doing. I heard Amy talking about it at Windy City that I met some of their interns and stuff. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to begin to do that. This Apartment 3A is such a diverse cast, and it's great, you know, because again, it's characters that anybody can be. Everybody falls in love, you know, whether you're big, small, black, white, male, female, you have love in your life.
All right, my last question for you.
Yep.
I mean, you came here in the 90s because you auditioned for a Goodman show.
Right.
You got it.
Got
you
it.
Left Buffalo. You
yep.
left New York City.
Yep.
You've worked in other towns. But what is it about Chicago? What kept you here for 20 years doing theater? And not only just theater, but what kept you in this town as a working and a professional?
Well, that's funny. That's funny because, that's true. I just think it's the... I fell in love with the city when I first... I came here a couple of times before I thought about moving here, just to visit. And it's on 90, the Route 90, right? And I lived in Buffalo. I lived on Route 9, off of Route 90. So when I first drove here, I right from my house, got on 90, ended up in Chicago.
On the expressway, right.
And I fell in love with it. And, you know, just the... Not only the theater, but all the art that's here, you know. And just recently, in the last few years... Even though I've been at court all those years, I really didn't appreciate or know about all the art in Hyde Park and the people, the artists that I've met, you know, and the art that I've seen. And so the community, like we were talking earlier, the difference between New York and Chicago. I just think it's very, you know, family oriented, you know, the African festivals that they have down there in Hyde Park and, you know, just exploring that. So I just fell in love with the energy of the city.
Ron O.J. Parson, longtime theater director. His new play is the Windy City Playhouse. The Chicago premiere of Jeff Daniels' Apartment 3A opens on Thursday. He's also doing East Texas Hot Links, a play by Eugene Lee. It's at the Writers Theater later in October. Ron, great to see you. Thanks for coming in to be my guest.
Hey, man, it's great to be here. I'll come anytime you want me.
Coming up, we're going to talk with Doug Plank. Monday night, Doug Plank joins us to talk Bears. That was a big win yesterday, although I love the Sun-Times headline today. Jay Hu and a picture of Brian Hoyer. We'll ask Doug about it. He just heard Kaz saying, this team is so much better with the Hoyer behind. It's like Josh McCown all over again. I mean, I don't know what to think. I'll ask Doug about this, whether or not that's just it's anyone but at this point. Anyone but Cutler. Are we at that stage in Chicago where it is just... This football marriage has to end. Some form where it just feels like whatever he does, he can't do. I mean, he gets hurt, and we're like, oh, the backup. He scored 2 touchdowns. You know, they're showing highlights on the halftime of Monday Night Football, Julio Jones going for 300 yards receiving. He went for 300 yards receiving, and they put up 48 points on the Carolina Panthers defense, the Atlanta Falcons. And our guy, we got 17 points and won a nail biter on an onside kick that I was very high school-like to get the win. And we're like, hey, hey, this is Brian Hoyer's team.
Hey, they missed a field goal. It could have been 20.
That's right. You're right. You're absolutely right. Defense played well. All right, so Doug, coming up after the 9 o'clock news, looking forward to it. Thanks, Rob. We can play this song with pride now. Let's play it out. Or not. This song, this we need a remix on this one. Even Doug Plank thinks we need a remix on the fight song for the Bears, right, Doug? You think it might be time to get like a mashup, something new, maybe get a new DJ beat, something for the kids to get involved with this millennial team. A lot of young players on this team, right?
Yes, you know, a millennial moment, I think, has come. I mean, I think that song is probably, its day has come and gone in the past. But, you know, it's still so, Justin, it was such a welcome relief to see the Bears on the winning side.
Oh, my gosh. Doug Plank joins us. We had talked about this. We had yet to have a conversation of a Bears win.
Yes.
We got it against the Lions at Soldier Field. The Sun-Times and other analysts reacted accordingly. We've seen the Sun-Times headline today is Jay Who? And it shows Brian Hoyer and the official quarterback controversy is on in Chicago. Everyone believes Brian Hoyer is the new deal. What do you make of this in Chicago? You've been a Chicago Bear. You've been an analyst. You've been a coach.
Yes.
Every time a backup quarterback does anything that's more than just fumbling the ball, we're calling for a change.
Yeah, and you know what? I think this, you know, just listening to some of the comments, not only after the game, but even before the game, you know, how many analysts were totally frustrated with the Chicago Bears, the way they played, mistakes that they had made. You know, I think this game could pretty much be, you know, summed up. You have to give them credit for their effort. I mean, I think, you know, Brian Hoyer did an excellent job getting out of the pocket, being able to throw a couple times on the run accurately downfield. I mean, you could definitely see there was a lot of effort by the Chicago Bears. I'm glad they won at home. I mean, the fans, the Soldier Field, you know,
yeah.
Chicago Bear fans, really, it was time. And, you know, it goes back to one of those other things, though. You could see where they made plenty of mistakes, you know, allowed the Lions to come off the edge again defensively, you know, which probably could have caused a fumble back in the pocket. You know, special teams were still suspect, but they did just enough to win the game.
They did, you know, and obviously a late punt return made this closer than the game was. But the Chicago Bears, let's talk about momentum, because you saw the Bears when they wanted to play the game they came out to play, the game plan.
Yes.
And everything. They were able to move the ball at will, the nice mix between run and pass. And more importantly, the halftime adjustments and the ability to stem the tide of momentum changes. That's what I thought the win was for this Bears team.
You know what? And I have to agree with you 100%, Justin. I think, you know, looking back at the three previous losses, you know, it looked as though the game plan coming out of the locker room at the beginning of the game was the same game plan they used throughout the entire game. And, you know, it's frustrating. You can't do it. You know, it's how many coaches and players have said, you know, the game plan is good until you meet the enemy. And, you know, in the NFL, things change and, you know, teams react. And I think the Bears really did a good job of changing things up, both defensively and offensively. And, you know, yes, it was the Detroit Lions. But, you know, you look back, you know, I don't think the Bears had beaten the Lions
for the last couple years. Yeah.
So yeah, it was a proud moment. I just happened to look at, like, a lot of the analysts, you know, going into the game. And, you know, even though, you know, some points, some people had favored even the Chicago Bears, without any question, you know, the majority of the analysts were pointing towards the Lions. But, you know, that's, you know, every time now and then, though, you know, things just work out. I mean, things go the right way. You get open, you make the good throws and catches. And I think the Bears did enough of that, you know, to win the football game. And, you know, I thought it was pretty respectable. The effort, the execution in the game. And hopefully, I don't know if this will be enough to get them back on track.
Yeah.
Let's hope so.
Well, you know, the Lions beat the Colts in a shootout. They lost to the Packers in a shootout. I mean, they have played high-octane offensive football. So let's talk about the Bears' defense, who really shut Matt Stafford down. Confused him. He threw errant balls, a couple interceptions. The pass rush may not have been there. I don't know if there were. I don't know how many sacks, maybe one or two throughout the day, but it really felt like Vic Fangio and the Bears' defense stepped up to take away whatever the Lions were trying to do.
I mean, I have to agree 100%. I mean, so many times this year, the defense just wasn't there, and it looked almost like an Arena Football League game. You know, score, 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 score by the other team. I thought the defense did a good job, and I have to agree with you, Justin. You know, just watching Stafford back in the pocket, under duress sometimes, scrambling around, you know, getting sacked. I thought the Bears did an excellent job, not just the secondary, because I think they made some great plays on the ball, you know, in terms of breaking plays up, making the tackles in the open field, which we didn't really see in previous weeks, where, you know, opposing receivers caught the ball short and just ran forever. It didn't seem like those passes were open. Those routes weren't open. You know, I thought the defense as a whole played very well. And even though they didn't get to Stafford every time, they put enough pressure on him to make some bad throws.
And, you know, I will say, I saw this yesterday. I watched the game closely. Jonathan Bullard and Leonard Floyd, both the rookies that were their, you know, top draft picks, first and second round, respectively, they didn't see a lot of time on the field. I saw Leonard Floyd be replaced by Sam Acho and Willie Young on the other side. And it seemed like early on in the season, Vic Fangio was getting a lot of heat for playing those rookies, and those rookies are making mistakes. It seemed like he peeled back a little bit. Is that an indication of losing faith in some of the rookies, or how does it work when you don't see those rookies on the field, especially in pressure and crunch time in the fourth quarter?
You know what? I don't know what the exact situation is with Young and Floyd. You're right. I didn't see much of them in the game either. I mean, when they came in, it looked like they contributed. But, you know, let me just say that I've seen situations where literally the general manager walks down to the defensive meeting room and literally pounds on the door and tells the defense, this course, this was years back with Buddy Ryan and Jim Finks. And he just basically calls out the defensive coordinator right in front of all the other players. You're going to play this guy. Hmm. And, you know, he did that. You know, I remember one week with Mike Singletary way back when Mike was just a rookie. And it's crazy to see these things unfold behind the scenes. You know, of course, never going to make it to the media, you know, but things like that happen. And I have to think in this situation, I think there was probably a decision made, maybe up in the front office, maybe down in the coaching meetings. But they just said, you know what? Okay, these younger players, you know, may have a great career in the National Football League, but it probably is not going to be this weekend.
We're talking with Doug Plank. We talk with him every Monday after a Bears game. This is a victory, of course. Let's talk about the offensive side of the ball. Jordan Howard, the rookie, we were clamoring for him. I'm not sure why. There wasn't a lot of tape on him. We saw him in the preseason. But,
no,
you know, the Bears' running back situation is really unsettled since Matt Forte left. Jeremy Langford hasn't shown much, and he's injured now. Howard comes in. He shows a big body. He brings a little bit of that A-Train Anthony Thomas feel back to the Chicago Bears, where, you know, we're seeing a little bit more plotting, but he's hitting the hole, and he's got a little bit of burst of speed. And the kid put 111 yards up on the Lions. That's got to be a huge part of why the Bears won that game.
You know, it was impressive, Justin. Here's the way I say, too. Those were hard yards. I mean, it wasn't like he was running down the sideline and nobody was touching
right,
him.
Right, right.
Many of those times, he came through the line of scrimmage or caught a short pass, little swing pass, and he did an awesome job. I mean, I went back and watched a couple of those plays over again. He made the right cuts, great body language, coming down the field, you know, just making defenders thinking he was either going inside or outside. And I loved his effort. I mean, he just absolutely refused to go down on a couple of those plays, really took a couple defensive players with him. I mean, it just looked like the Bears wanted to win again. And that's what summed up the whole game. I mean, I think their passing game and most importantly their running game really is an illustration and a bar, you know, as far as you know, how exactly they wanted to go out and win and how much effort they were willing to put forth.
I guess that's why you see on the front of the Sun-Times or Jimmy Johnson saying, you know, Jay Cutler's played his last snap, you know, for the Chicago Bears. I guess that's just what you see because, you know, when you see a group of backups and players come together with maximum effort and they're showing that focus and determination and chemistry, that's something that we haven't seen. And I wonder if that's why there's a push to say, even though we all know that Jay Cutler may be a better quarterback, he may have better skills than the backup quarterback, he's missing that piece that essentially is what we saw on the field yesterday, which is this collective win where everyone just went all in.
I have to agree 100%. I think every single player on that field was playing for each other. They were doing everything they could, not just on a couple plays, every play, play after play after play. I mean, you could just see that the effort was there, the concentration. You know, they were willing to play hard, which the line, I thought the line both ways, the offensive, defensive line, just did a much, much better job. And you know, this is not a game where you just absolutely put players on a board or on a graph or whatever and you say, okay, this guy can throw the ball far further than anybody else, or this guy's faster. Hey, listen, what can he do on the field? How are his skills translating into production on the field? I don't care how fast or big or strong the guy is. If he's not producing on the field, then you got to go with somebody else. And I think, hate to say it, but I mean, I think that's where the Chicago Bears are right now. You know, we talked before about what little percentage they have as far as getting into the playoffs after that 0-3 start. Mm-hmm. I think you go with guys that chemistry, man. It's about chemistry, believing in each other, and most importantly, having the fans watch the team and really, really enjoy what's taking place.
This is a carbon copy of what happened last year for the Bears. We saw John Fox team start 0-3. We even talked about it last week, and then they got a victory at home against Oakland, and then they put another one up on the road against Kansas City, which was a big game. I mean, the Bears, I mean, we're looking for improvement year to year. The idea that they're going carbon copy and they got a chance to go to Indianapolis now and get to 2-3, I mean, it's not enough. It's not enough in year two to say that this is a good thing that the Bears won a game at home against the Lions, right?
No, I mean, honestly, you know, you go back these, you know, with Mark Trestman and now even coming in the first few years with Coach Fox. I mean, I don't think these are years that any Chicago Bear fan's going to look back on and go, oh, my God, can you remember 2016? What a season! 2015, 2014. I'm telling you, these are going to be those years like back in the 70s, you know, where there was a block of like 6 or 7 or 8 years, you just rather roll up and, you know, put it into oblivion because there was nothing.
Before
really
Doug Plank got there,
that.
Before you got to Chicago, right?
I mean, you know, there was some tackles and, you know, a few runs and stuff like that. But, you know, let's face it, it's a team sport. And for the fans, you know, obviously they enjoy individual effort, but it's team success which really makes the difference. And I think that's where really every analyst and every fan and media, you know, also I think they're just wishing and hoping that the Bears, you know, could start gaining some success like they've had in the past. And especially, you know, with the Cubs having such a fantastic season, it would really been nice to follow up their season with a winning Bears season.
I wonder if it takes a little bit of the pressure off because all Chicago sports fans are like, man, we can watch the Cubs. But let's talk about Indianapolis as we wrap up here. Indianapolis loses in London against Jacksonville.
Yes.
But there's something about this Indianapolis team, which is 1-3, but almost in every single game they have gone down to the wire in this hocus-pocus kind of Andrew Luck, last-minute two-point conversion kind of stuff. This team is never out. Do the Bears have a chance to go into Indianapolis and defeat Andrew Luck and the Colts?
You know what? Everything is about what happened last week. And, you know, it's the old memory thing. If you've lost the week before, Justin, you're humbled. I mean, you are humbled, especially in a game that they're playing over in London, you know, where they know the whole country is watching them, you know, replays of the game or watching it live. And, you know, I just think there's going to be a tremendous pressure on them to come out and play well. Now, I know the Chicago Bears won, but like I said before, there were plenty of errors, mistakes, and breakdowns, which they could look at this game and say, man, we can take advantage of these guys. We can do it here or there. So I would expect, boy, the Colts, I think they're going to give everything they can. I mean, I think they're going to come out mentally and physically ready to play against this game. And that doesn't mean the Bears can't carry some enthusiasm and some momentum into this game. I just think, you know, it's tough going into Indianapolis and winning.
Yeah, and Andrew Luck, and they're 1-3, and they can't really afford to go 1-4 in that division or in the AFC. So, hey, I mean, but this is the hole you dig, you know, the idea that the Bears, every game they play now is going to be a must-win until they get to a better vantage point, I guess. Doug Plank, the great number 46, joins us every Monday or Tuesday, depending on when the Bears play, to break down the game. Doug, great as always. Thanks for joining us, bud.
No, Justin, awesome. I hope we're talking about another victory next week.
Yes, go Bears. More to come tonight on The Download. Andy Zaltzman's here. Andy's awesome, the Bugle podcast. He does with John Oliver. He's been doing it for years. They're retooling the podcast, been on hiatus. It's coming back in October with new special guests. John Oliver, obviously, the last week tonight is... too busy for the show, which is a bummer. That was a good podcast. I know you're a big fan of the podcast as well, Pete. So we'll talk with Andy, who is at the House of Blues doing a show tomorrow, stand-up show at the House of Blues here, right over here on Dearborn. So Andy in studio, talk to us about satire, politics, the Bugle podcast, much, much more. So that's coming up. Also 10 o'clock, Studio 435, the band Laverne in studio, Chicago band, indie rock, pure pop, as they say. I don't know who says it, but they said it. It's written all over the internet, pure pop. I'll ask him what that means, so I'm not sure what that means. We'll figure it out. And coming up here on The Download. Thanks, Rob. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Patty Vasquez takes over at 11. 10 o'clock hour, Studio 435, the band Laverne. Be performing here in our showcase studio. But right now, my next guest, one of the best satirists in the UK, Andy Zaltzman, is a stand-up comedian who's performing tomorrow night at the House of Blues right here over on Dearborn. Andy's been performing comedy for years, a mainstay in London, including an impressive run at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. A good 10, 12 years of doing that festival. It's awesome. You can hear him on the Bugle podcast, which has been produced since 2007. Zaltzman co-hosts a podcast with John Oliver. Although in recent years, Oliver's taken somewhat of a back seat. The Bugle is one of the best comedy podcasts going, and it's been on hiatus for a bit, but it's coming back in mid-October, sans Oliver. Andy Zaltzman joins me now. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, that's great.
This is a huge pleasure for us.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be in Chicago. I've been wanting to come here for years.
So. That's good. Is this your first time?
First time. It's my first day in Chicago.
So. And you go right into the radio station on Michigan Avenue. I love it.
Yeah.
As you told me a little bit earlier, staying in Logan Circle, which is, that's good.
That's good. All right. It's near enough, isn't it?
It's near enough. You know, all right, so let's talk. I mean, the big news, obviously, the Bugle podcast, which is a wildly successful podcast. You're retooling it. You're starting it back up here in October without John.
Yes. John Oliver sadly had to retire from Bugle duty. Because things aren't going too well for him, and he's having to get a regular 9-to-5 job, I think, running a hot dog stand in Manhattan somewhere. So he can't do it anymore due to the pressures of being the I don't know. It seems to be he's become the conscience of America. I'll be coming back with rotating guest co-hosts from various places around the world.
I mean, you guys have been doing this podcast and working together for a long time, both stand-ups coming out of London. I mean, talk about retooling this without John. I mean, it's got to be strange to think about this project without him.
Yes, it will be clearly different. I hope it'll work. It's quite exciting to be doing it with different people. I guess we've got different perspectives. Like I said, I'll be a bit more global rather than just being two Brits on... One on the correct side of the Atlantic, one on the wrong side of the Atlantic, as I like to think of it. And I think I hope our listeners will stick with it or come back to it, because we have been rather sporadic for the last couple of years. So,
that's the beauty of having a podcast too, is you can make those rules. You set the rules and of how you're going to produce this podcast, right?
Yes. It does help if those rules are produce the podcast. recently, we've not been producing the podcast, so. So it'll be nice to get back, it'll be a weekly show again, as it was for most of, I guess, the first 7 or 8 years.
You know, I was reading about it and being someone who's listened to the podcast, I mean, it's interesting that it's two Brits talking a lot about U.S. politics. Obviously, John Oliver's John's career is based on that and what happened last week tonight. But talk about that, the concept of being foreigners talking about U.S. politics and why that works.
Well, I guess it helps to have an outsider's perspective. I think comedically, that's generally quite a good thing to have, and I think it's, I guess, one of the things that John's used since he came here to work on the Daily Show. And we started doing the Bugle just over a year after he started on the Daily Show, so he was already sort of fully immersed in the utterly crazy, baffling world of American politics and news media. So I guess it was natural that would be a strong strand of.
Is it that? I mean, for you, I mean, being a London-based comedian, I mean, we've known of all the foibles and slip-ups of English politics for years. I mean, is it that different, the U.S. experience versus the U.K. experience?
I think it's very different, particularly this year. Everything just seems a lot higher pitched in America. In Britain, it can be almost as crazy, but it's conducted with at least a veneer of politeness, even if there is a deep anger and impoliteness beneath it. Whereas in America, it all just comes flooding to the fore through the various news outlets and strange politicians who.
What we got when talking about Brexit. What we got was this idea that the Donald Trump of Britain politics, they won there. That was the story here of saying, I mean, is that the accurate way to think about how the Brexit vote kind of played out?
Yes. I mean, there's a strong element of it being an anti-politics vote, as I guess, that's a lot of Trump's appeal, is that he's from outside the system. And, the mainstream parties in Britain were in favour of remaining part of the European Union. I also think fundamentally Britain just got bored as a nation. It's like being left in a room with an electric socket and nothing else. At some point you're going to stick your fingers in it just to see what happens. And that's essentially what we did with Brexit. So now we just have to... We voted for Brexit, but we didn't know what it was. So now we just have to wait for fate and history to tell us we voted for.
I feel like
for.
You're only a couple months ahead of us. Right? That's the same concept. It's a lot of electric sockets in America.
Well, at least, if the election goes, the way you don't want it, whichever way you're saying, it's only 4 years, whereas Brexit is basic. That's the next 1,000 years or something for us. We're going to have to deal with that, which is good from a comedic point of view.
Right.
That's a good millennium of material.
For you
up.
As a comic, what drew you to being a satirist or being more involved and more astute on politics as opposed to other social issues?
Well, a number of things. I always enjoyed sort of watching political comedy before I started doing it. Also, I mean, observational comedy, maybe a sort of more lucrative career path, but I don't think I've ever had a single funny observation. So I would have been really, really bad at it.
Right.
So I guess sort of gravitated towards.
We gotta find those lost tapes. You're practicing observation.
Yeah, and
comedy.
Also, I've come from a stable family background. I have a wife who has been devoted and supportive over the she's given me absolutely nothing to work with from a career perspective. She's been disastrous. But so I had to find comedy elsewhere.
Andy Saltzman is a stand-up comedian who will be at the House of Blues tomorrow night. He also does the Bugle podcast, which has been done with John Oliver. The thing I also mentioned was, an unbelievable run at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Talk about that festival, because that's one that I'm not sure a lot of people recognize. I mean, that I've been to Edinburgh during the festival. I've done the festival. That is a tremendous, tremendous opportunity for comics, especially London comics, to come up and get sort of a worldwide appeal.
Maybe
not worldwide, but maybe appeal.
Yeah, you say worldwide appeal. Generally, it's talking to about 15 people in a sweaty room. So, if you want to call that worldwide appeal, I'm happy to run with that.
Well, there's two people from New Zealand. There's somebody from France. And the other five people are Americans who are lost.
Yeah.
And then, so that's worldwide.
But it's worldwide. Yeah, that sticks. But it's a great way to sort of learn your craft early in your career, to get to do your own hour-long show. I think it's where you really discover what you want to be as a comedian. I think all the best British comedians, certainly of my generation, sort of learnt their craft doing Edinburgh year after year. And John Oliver did it early in his career. We did shows together up there. In fact, when he got the Daily Show job, we were just about to do a two-handed show, and about 2 weeks before Edinburgh he fled the country.
Did you have to play both parts?
Or did
you kill the show?
Yeah, we tended to work to deadline, so it wasn't like we were losing a show we'd written. It was more that I was having to write one from scratch on my own instead of with John. So, I mean, quite why he chose not to do an Edinburgh Fringe show in favour of joining the world's leading satirical comedy show. I mean, it baffles me to this day. But though it's a great fun festival, as you know, having done it, and it's a kind of creative melting pot and a great opportunity to try out jokes that don't necessarily work in comedy clubs in front of a load of bachelor parties and people who are drunk.
I mean, that's true. You hone your craft in the clubs with that, right?
Yeah.
When you set out on an American tour, when you're doing a show at House of Blues and your first time through Chicago, I mean, are you specifically tailoring material to American audiences? Are you just bringing your act from London? Talk about the show you're going to put on at the House of Blues.
Well, the show I'm doing on this tour is called Satirist for Hire. So people can email me the topics they want me to talk about in the show. So it's not me tailoring my material. It's my audience tailoring my material. So it's a different show every time. I do a lot of writing for every show.
All right.
And, I've got a selection of the emails. There's already quite a good crop for the show at House of Blues.
Okay, good.
Tomorrow, American audiences appear to be much keener on sending in their suggestions than British audiences. So I've been slightly inundated in some of the earlier gigs on the tour. But I've been asked to satirise the fact that four of the last eight Illinois governors have ended up on the wrong side of the prison gates.
Right.
Being asked to satirise the Chicago hot dog. Obviously, Donald Trump comes up in quite a lot of email. I mean, that's a big political issue, isn't it? The Chicago hot dog.
The Chicago is so political. Yeah. Mustard or ketchup?
Yeah.
You're not supposed to put ketchup on a hot dog, Chicago hot dog.
I got an email from a British person living in Chicago saying, why am I not allowed to have ketchup on my... So that's one of the big issues I'm going to have to address.
Nobody knows the answer to that, but that is a steadfast rule.
Alongside Trump, the gun situation in America, global warming... the Peruvian archaeological site at Machu Picchu. Someone's requested that. So it's a very varied show. And why America prefers baseball to cricket, which is, baffles us on...
It does. There was, I will say this, I was with my, I have a 9-year-old son, and we were in the park, and I was throwing the football around, and I looked over, and there was a full-on cricket match going on in the park in Chicago, right on the west side. And I was like, this is amazing. And I really tried to get his attention, and I found myself failing as a dad who was trying to, because I had no idea what the rules were. So I'm like, now watch the guy with the stick. Now he's running the, what's that guy doing? I don't know what that guy's doing, but this is great, isn't it? Like, that's how it felt. But, I mean, they're similar in the way they set up, but they're pretty different.
Yeah, I mean,
sports.
You can use baseball as a gateway sport into cricket. I mean, we did give you Americans the chance to have cricket, and for some baffling reason, you spurned it.
We did not. I think it's the fact that we need that weird long 45-second delay between pitches. That's baseball.
We have that in cricket, and we drag it out over 5 days as well. Proper Test match cricket,
that's true.
International match, 5 days, and it might be a draw at the end. So. it gives you 5 days off from everything else. You can just ignore everything.
Wow.
We're in baseball, 3 hours, and you got to go back to reality.
Yeah, that would be good. Could you imagine if there was Cubs playoffs games for 5 days? Just one game was 5 days? Oh, I like that.
Yeah, I think baseball should embrace. I mean,
you need some rule changes.
You can stretch your season out impressively.
See, this is what you have to talk about. It's baseball week here. I mean, I've heard you talk about the fact that cricket has led you to American baseball. You had a roommate at one point. You were able to talk about that. So you do get into American baseball.
Yes. No, I've been to my first couple of games on this tour. I saw the Yankees play the Red Sox, and I saw the Phillies play the Mets. I love it. It's I can watch most sports that don't involve a car or a horse, and. I mean, there's already enough sports in my life. So I probably don't need to be fully embracing American sports as well. But they're quite fascinating. And just they seem to be the wallpaper for American life now. Just everywhere you go, bars, cafes, college football, high school football. I think they had embryo football filmed in a womb. There seems no end to what you can film and broadcast.
Right. It really is. There's a lot of TVs in these bars. Yeah. They have to fill the TVs.
Yeah, I was at a place in Philadelphia that had not only lots of individual TVs, but a big bank of 9 screens all showing different sports. No, the human eye, even my human eye, cannot take in that much sport at once. You've got to make some editorial choices when you have a bank of 9 TV screens.
Well, I think, you obviously can talk about the Cubs. tomorrow. I think that will work because the Cubs play Friday. This is a huge year for us. We're going to the World Series.
Yes. In fact, the first time I came to America was October 2003, and... should I stop this sentence now?
No, you're good.
But I mean, I remember that vividly. That was quite a spectacular postseason. I understand it didn't go massively well here.
It didn't. And ESPN showed a documentary maybe like 10 years after the fact or 12 years. And it was just showed like a real sour part of humanity. Like it had a bunch of footage inside the park after Bartman grabbed the ball and how everybody was like yelling at him. And it got real dirty. Right. It got real dark.
But you've all forgiven and forgotten now, haven't you?
I think everybody has. Yeah. Let me speak for Chicago when I say forgiven. Right. Andy Zaltzman in studio with me, stand-up comedian, is going to be performing at the House of Blues tomorrow night. Here on Dearborn, Satirist for Hire is the name of the show. Is it too late to give out the email?
Oh, no, the email, if you're coming to the show, is satirisethis@satiristforhire.com. And I even set it up so that you can spell satirize both in the correct British way with a second S or in the incorrect American way with a Z. It feels wrong, say a Z.
Yeah, no, you could do it. The Z will probably work out, but that's a good idea to add the S on there as well, just in case somebody spells it that way in Chicago.
Yeah.
Right. All right. So, you know, I'm interested because obviously politics and sports, they both play a big role in your show, and you're going to be talking about the governors, which is a huge issue here. But one of the other issues in Chicago, and Chicago is not a necessary, I mean, we'll have just like, In all around the country, we have a lot of problems with voter turnout. We have a lot of problem with voter apathy. There's this concept where, you know, on a good day, 25% of the populace vote. You know, you talk about this in your act. You talk about this a lot. Just that we're at a stage where, I mean, it's amazing that we don't have full participation when it comes to voting.
It's incredible. You're generally around just over 50% in presidential elections. We had the Brexit vote was 72% turnout in Britain, which people seem to think was good. I thought was that's still 28%
didn't even
couldn't be bothered to write an X in a box in the biggest democratic decision of their lives. That deserved some symbols in the background. So I think it's a big issue around the democratic world. We love democracy. That's one of the defining features of our kind of our politicians. Oh, we're democracy, freedom loving people, and yet we kind of look at it and think,
the city did the runoff elections or when it was just for the mayor, I mean, I think that the final vote total was like 31%.
Right.
Here in Chicago for mayor.
Yes. I mean, it does suggest that maybe they should, you know, just try having no go. I mean, if this is what the people want, just have no government. Actually, I mean, if it was a choice between no government and the government you might get on November the 9th. I mean,
I think that's what's happening. It's a referendum on no government.
Yeah. Yes. So strange times that we fight wars to give people democracy and then forget to use it ourselves.
Man. Andy Zaltzman, great to meet you. Stand-up comedian who's performing tomorrow night, House of Blues, couple of streets over here on Dearborn. Mainstay in London. You can hear him on the Bugle podcast. When's the Bugle podcast coming back?
So recording the first one back on the 21st of October, so it'll be out probably late that day or early on the 22nd recording that with Hari Kondabolu.
It's been on the show, that's right, yeah.
So it'll be a rotating cast, a comedian in India called Anuvab Pal, who's a very fine Indian satirist. He'll be one of the guests. It'll be a new kind of global bugle. We'll see what happens. I'll miss John, but maybe.
Andy, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it, man.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
That was fun, Pete. Andy Zaltzman in studio. Yeah, I listened to a bunch of the Bugle just recently. Good stuff. John Oliver leaving the Bugle because he can't handle it. He can't handle doing a show on HBO and a podcast. Come on. I didn't even get to... I had a whole list of questions and I didn't get there, but I want to ask him. He does a pun... It's called a pun run. And it's essentially like Andy's very into puns. So I could ask him about that.
All the blues puns.
Yeah, he's got blues. He says he's got Because he's playing House of Blues. Blues in Chicago. He's got a bunch of blues puns. So there's that.
Next time.
Next time. Absolutely. Coming up, Studio 435, the band Laverne setting up in studio as we speak. I'm excited about this. Yeah, the crowds are gathering. They probably won't stick around for more than 2 minutes, though. I'm not going to lie to you guys. That's how it usually works. They get a wave, and then they go, oh, well, time to get going. That's just how it works here. That's Michigan Avenue for you. Unless you're in the morning. Like I said, at the beginning of the show, I filled in the morning. They don't look up. They walk by on Michigan Avenue, man. They got the biggest coffees I've ever seen in my life, where they just, like, get the extra, extra, extra large from Dunkin' Donuts, and they are rolling. I mean, they are moving. Yeah, they're just ready to go. They're ready to go. They are not waving in the mirror. They're not waving in the window for the old download, I'll tell you that. They're like, phew. All right, the band Laverne coming up. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Studio 435, our live performance series before featuring the best Chicago music, Chicago bands. Today we feature the power pop indie rock music of the band Laverne. Laverne's self-titled album is out now, released this summer back in June. They have a show coming up at the Empty Bottle, opening up for the Born Ruffians on October 13th. Laverne is Corey Clifford, Kinsey Ring, Sam Brown, and Ed McMenamin. Close enough, right? Over now. All right, here they are performing Sad, Sad Chap. Take it away, guys.
What does it boil down to? Let me know soon, because I've got a crush on Molly Rankin. I've been thinking about leaving this whole world behind my eyes. And I'm crazy, I'm a bit lazy, things are hazy, and I'm dumber than you think. And slowly, with hours less slowly, I've been feeling lonely as I continue to drink. What's on the other side of life? A sliced banana that's rotted nicely. Precisely what you'd expect. Oh, I'm a train wreck waiting to happen. And I'm crazy, I'm a bit lazy, things are hazy, and I'm dumber than you think. And slowly, that was less slowly, I've been feeling lonely as I continue to drink and 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 drink. I drink, whoa!
Give it up. The band Laverne in studio 435 tonight. The song Sad Sad Chap. Great song. They'll have a show coming up at the Empty Bottle, opening up for the Born Ruffians on October 13th. Corey Clifford, Kinsey Ring, Sam Brown, and Ed McKenneman in studio tonight. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll hear from these guys and hear some more music here on The Download, 720 WGN. It's The Download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Patty Vasquez takes over. Studio 435, the Chicago band Laverne, power pop of indie rock. Is that the best? I mean, I have at the desk here Corey Clifford and Ed McMenamin. Say it, go ahead.
McMenamin.
I love that we've got Sam Brown, and we've also got Kinsey Ring. Those are easy, but they're not on the mic. I get Ed McMenamin. Menamin.
You got it.
All right, talk about, I mean, when I say those words, those buzzwords that mean absolutely nothing, power pop, indie rock, what is the genre, what is the categorization that you prefer for the band Laverne?
I would say we're very, like, hyper, I would say, like, lyrical power pop is what we've said in the past. We've also just said, like, I don't know, like, guitar pop, which is also very basic. But I think at the end of the day, it's just we're kind of a catch-all of a bunch of different things with a strong emphasis on lyrics and kind of melodies that recall, like, 70s and 80s British indie pop and like American college rock. So
where'd you guys get together? Talk about the origins of Laverne.
So Ed runs a record label called Dumpster Tapes, and he put out our last band, my last band, Pine Box, and he and I have become friends over the years. And when Pine Box fizzled out, me and, like, Sam were kind of jamming together, and me and Ed were living together at the time, and then we were like, I was like, oh, yeah, Ed's really good at guitar. Let's have Ed play in the band. And then we had our old bassist has played in the bands Gross Point and Cafe Racer, and recently we just got Kinsey, who's, like, the best bassist we've all ever met, so we're pretty excited. He's really good.
What makes him such a great bassist?
Kinsey just, like, he's funky, and but he also, I think, understands where to draw the line between, like, really solid melody and musicianship, and it's, like, kind of a blend of both. So,
well, let me ask you about that, both of you guys. When it comes to musicianship and the things that go with it, I mean, talk about your training. I mean, is this the kind of band that gets together and your friends and you picked up, you self-taught each other how to play the instruments? Or, I mean, did you guys go to school for this, and is this sort of your skill?
I grew up, like, pretty working class with, like, the same guitar for, like, 10 years. And I just kind of, like, worked off online, like, chord sheets. So I was, like, learning all, like, back in the day when I was 14 or 15, learning, like, every Franz Ferdinand song or, like, you know, whatever, like, 14 or 15 year olds liked.
Right.
Well, 14 or 15 year olds who were as, like, geeky as me liked. And it was like that and Block Party, and that was just kind of the music I was learning. So I didn't really have a lot of solid training, but I learned enough chords from learning those songs.
Yeah,
that,
right.
That's kind of like been the emphasis of where I went.
How about, I think you learned too many chords.
Yeah.
Try and keep up.
Well, Ed, how about you? I mean, where do you get your style of guitar playing?
I took guitar lessons at a music shop in middle school and early high school. I think at that time it was a lot of like what every 14-year-old wants to play, which is like Led Zeppelin riffs and that kind of stuff. And it can be hard to get away from the riff stuff and more into what I like now, which is more along the lines of what Laverne plays. I mean, I still love Led Zeppelin, but it's not maybe what I want to play.
We have talked about doing Led Zeppelin covers because even though I think I sing pretty mid-range, I can get pretty high up there. So
yeah.
If I really try. So.
Well, I mean, there's something to it. I mean, to be able to play the kind of power pop stuff, the lyrical power pop stuff that you guys are playing, I mean, it goes further beyond sort of the riff kind of guitar playing that, you know, that is being taught at you know, guitar lessons, things of that nature. How do you get from that to what you guys are doing here?
I would say we definitely are all big, like, record buffs and music nerds, and I feel like what it boils down to, good songwriting comes from listening to good music, and that's just across the board. You got to listen to the bad music, too, but really it's like, I don't want to say homework because it's not a studious thing. It doesn't feel like it, but when you're trying to write really good songs, you're going to look from about 40 to 50 different records that really made your songwriting style what it is.
Ned, do you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we bonded, me and Corey, over music. That's where our friendship started. It was just always talking about new records that we bought or whatever we were into that week. So,
and I'd say good amount on Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
All right, there we go. All right, the band Laverne in studio. Let's play another track. What do you guys want to play?
Cool. This is called Monster of Love.
Monster of Love. Okay, hold on 1 second. I don't see Bob. We need Bob on the mix. He'll be in just a second. Monster of Love. Where's this one come off? This is off the self-titled,
and in a way, it's kind of like a sequel to the Sparks song "Eaten by the Monster of Love."
Okay, so good. Let me ask you guys. Putting out a record, putting out an album. It's just sort of your second kind of go around with it. Talk about what it takes to be able to put an album out these days. Obviously, to be able to distribute it is much differently because of the internet. But talk about just the concept, the process that you guys go through to write the music, record the music, and get it ready for production.
Well, this recent record, well, the new one that we're like actually recording right now, we've taken the time with and really like demoed out actually recently. And this one's going to be very big sounding.
The new one coming up.
A lot of like different instrumentation, mariachi horns, all sorts of crazy stuff. And but the first one was really just us getting together. We had 8 songs. We were like, let's do this. So we hit up our friend Dave, who runs Public House Sound Recordings, and he recorded us in pretty much a day.
Yeah, a day and a half.
A day and a half, and it was like that. And we already knew we were going to be able to put it out on Ed's tape label, so we were like, let's just do it, see how it goes. And really, like, among the music scene that we play in, we've gotten a lot of great feedback from bands we really love, like the Yolks and Flesh Panthers and La 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 La, all sorts of bands that are really good among the scene, so...
Well, I want to talk about the new music when we come back after the news. I also want to talk about the scene, because I'm always intrigued by where you guys fit in and where the scene's playing and where sort of you guys are hanging out and the bands that are like you are hanging out, so we at WGN Radio can get a better sense of where the scenes are at. The band Laverne in studio, Corey Clifford, Kinsey Ring, Sam Brown, and Ed McMenamin. All right, let's get you guys up on your instruments. Let's play the song. Sound good?
Yep.
All right. Band Laverne. Their show's coming up at the Empty Bottle. They're opening up for the Born Ruffians on October 13th. And their self-titled album, Laverne, is out now. It was released this summer. All right, guys, take it away.
Such a large palette for love, but my heart is much too small. I can't stomach big love at all. The computer is your alibi,
temptations go. I can't stomach big love at all. I've been eaten by the monster of love again. I've seen the illusion of seeing clearly through a cracked lens. I've been eaten by the monster of love again. I like that. I'm my best wingman and my worst friend. I've lost out on a year of my life, a year of loneliness. Yet those memories stick out the best. Pain and strife, the uncertainty, the nascent bitterness. Those memories stick out the best. I've been eaten by the monster of love again. I've seen the illusion of seeing clearly through a cracked lens. I've been eaten by the monster of love again and again. I'm my best wingman and my worst friend. Monster of love again. I've seen the illusion of sin clearly through a cracked lens. I've been eaten by the monster of love.
Laverne in studio, the Chicago power pop indie rock quartet, I guess you would say, is the show coming up at the Empty Bottle, opening up for the Born Ruffians on October 13th. Corey Clifford, Kinsey Ring, Sam Brown, and Ed McMenamin, they are our guests tonight, Studio 435, the band Laverne. We'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. We'll get one more out of these guys before we wrap. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Studio 435 rolls along in the Allstate Showcase studio here on Michigan Avenue with the band Laverne. At the mics right now, Corey Clifford and Ed McMenamin, both playing guitar for the band Laverne. Thanks for being here, guys. Thanks for performing.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Thank
that.
You.
All right, so, you know, we talked a little bit about new music. As you guys evolve and, you know, you already did the sort of recording at Public House and other places along the way. Talk about what the new music provides you. What how have you guys evolved as a band?
So I've definitely gotten more into like effect pedal playing guitar, and And the new record is just, I don't know, it's like a, it's a weird combination of like very dreamy rock music and then just kind of everything familiar along the way. Like there are certain songs that sound like in one instant, like it could sound like it could have been a Kink song, or it could have been like even like a Teenage Fan Club or Weezer song, you know? And then we have like some songs that it's like, it sounds very like shoegaze 90s dreamy, but then the vocals are almost kind of like Roxy Music or like a crooner kind of Dean Martin sort of thing. So
how do you guys, I mean, one of the things I noticed on the tracks that you guys played for us tonight is the arrangement. There's a lot of sort of stop, start, move around. It's very creative in the way that you're putting the songs together. Talk about where that comes from. I mean, is that something that's learned? Is that something that, like you said, is from listening to other music? Talk about the creative approach to arranging music.
I don't know. I'd say we just, I think, like, it's funny because if you go to our house, we listen, because me and Ed live together. If you go to our apartment, we listen to pretty simple music, but I don't know. There's something about, like, it's more fun to play when there's, like, tension in a song and, like, you're like, oh, wait a second. Oh, it's about to build, but then it cuts out. You're like, okay, where is this going? And then next thing you know, the song comes in. It's like a total, like, kind of country-ish.
You get that relief.
Yeah, you get the relief. It's like country meets, like, Orange Juice and the Smiths sort of feel, you know? So.
Well, I mean, there is something to that. I mean, the idea of the conflict and the resolution of a piece of music. I mean, yeah. You guys both, in a way, are self-taught musicians. But that is sort of, you know, that harkens back to the days of Mozart and you know, Beethoven and the concepts of using classical music to build and to release. I mean, you guys are doing the same thing with power pop in 2016.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what we try to do. With this new record that we're working on, it's very, like, I feel like the predictability you think is, like, totally about to be there, and then we just, like, kind of cut it down and build it back up.
Are you looking for that when you're creating music? I mean, is that something that is now part of your sort of canon when it comes to songwriting?
Yeah, I definitely would say so. As far as, like, a band goes, I think we like the idea of being able to perform something on record that really sounds great, but that we can still have the excitement come across in a live setting. So,
talk about how you guys produce the music. I mean, you talked about demoing the songs, but are you the kind of band that's going to take something that you want to put on an album that may not be finished and try it out live first, get it up on stage at the Empty Bottle or somewhere where you can see how it kind of flows in a more energetic setting?
Yeah, I think about half of our set at this point are songs that will be on the next record that we haven't recorded yet. I definitely like trying out the songs live and kind of figuring out what works, and you feel that from the crowd coming back. And then the few songs we have recorded for the upcoming album, you know, we've gotten to play those out a lot, and you kind of figure out what they're about.
When it comes to just the experiment in doing so, how do you guys deal with failure? How do you deal when something doesn't go right, where you think the song's going to break out and it's like bump and it hits and the audience is like, oh, I'm going to go get a beer. I mean, do you have like a almost, I don't want to be so corny about it, but do you have like a band meeting afterwards to talk about the songs and say that worked, that didn't, we can improve upon this, that kind of thing?
Maybe. Not exactly, though. I feel like as far as things go, most people are very supportive when it comes to like small local shows, but I don't know. There's never really been a moment where I think we were like, this part doesn't work. It was more so a moment where like, oh, okay, I screwed up this part, you know?
and a lot of that, like, oh, this part doesn't work, we figure out in practice.
Yeah, we usually figure that out before we would even show anybody. I think, you know, we'll hammer out a song for like a month straight. And then, you know, Sam or Kinsey or someone will be like, well, hey, is it cool if maybe we kind of do this part? Just to keep it more dynamic, to maybe make it have tension in the song, or even just to make it like a little more sensible. Because even though our songs may be like a little unpredictable, at the end of the day, we write pop songs, like for sure, you know?
So.
Okay, so talk about, you kind of talked about the supportive audience that you have. I'm interested in the scene. You know, you've talked about the bands that you go to who say, yeah, that stuff sounds great. You talk about the audience that you're playing stuff for. Where would you guys say is the epicenter of the Laverne scene when it comes to Chicago?
I don't know. We played in both garage scene, kind of like the DIY arts scene in Bridgeport. We played with emo bands. We played with all sorts of different music.
The label that I co-run with Alex Fryer is called Dumpster Tapes, and that's very much like the garage rock scene, which is a lot like Cole's Bar, the Empty Bottle, DIY spots like Wally World that doesn't exist anymore, and some places in Pilsen as well. And so we play in that scene, and then as well as, like Corey said, we can kind of, I think we have a varied enough sound where we can kind of hopscotch around a little bit.
I mean, what's the trajectory? I mean, when you talk about a scene like playing DIY shows in Pilsen or Bridgeport, I mean, is the trajectory to build that audience there to say we're going to do DIY shows here, we're going to sort of stay off the grid? Or is the goal to say, okay, now we're going to have a weekly presence at the Empty Bottle, or we're going to move up, you know, I don't know what's next, like, you know, we're going to play at Double Door or whatever it is. I don't know what the next step would you guys, but talk about that sort of evolving sort of ladder that you guys, the ambition of
take this one,
playing more spaces in Chicago.
I think Corey has a lot of ambition, and I do too, but my favorite bands play both. They never stop playing the DIY shows, and they can play the Bottle if they want to. You know, this is going to be our first time playing the Bottle in a week, so we're super stoked about that, because that's probably my favorite venue, along with Cole's. But
I think it's weird, too, because, you know, you'll play the DIY shows, and they're fun, and you're like, oh, you know, we might have screwed up, but we were drunk, and it doesn't really matter anyways. But we've played Lincoln Hall before, and I think what was really nice about playing a place like Lincoln Hall is, first and foremost, like, the people that work there, and at most, like, touring band venues, they really, like, take care of you. They're very, like, accommodating. They really set up your stuff. If something doesn't sound right, they tell you, and they're like, let's fix this right now. And I kind of like that, and even though I love playing DIY shows, it is kind of cool playing the big venues, especially with the touring bands. So,
well, the band Laverne will be at the Empty Bottle opening up for the Born Ruffians on October 13th. They've also got their self-titled album that's out now. Laverne was released this summer, and new music coming. When can we expect to see another album from you guys?
We're probably going to record it, and we've recorded 3 songs off of it. We're probably going to record 10 more this winter, and I don't know. I mean, I think we all agree we kind of want to shop big for this one. We think it's like the music's good enough. So,
what does that mean?
Try to shop it out to bigger independent labels. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think as long as people like the record, that's all we really care about.
There you go. So. Corey Clifford, Ed McMenamin, Sam Brown, Kinsey Ring, they are Laverne. Can we get one more out of you guys now?
Oh, yeah.
What are you going to play?
This is called This Winter, and this is off the next record.
This Winter, off the new album that's coming out. Laverne, live in Studio 435 in our Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue. Like I said, they'll be playing at the Empty Bottle coming up on October 13th. Take it away, guys.
The bruises on my hand made me feel restless.
Yeah, there we go. The band Laverne in studio. They're playing at the Empty Bottle, opening up for the Born Ruffians on October 13th. Their self-titled album's out now, Laverne. It was released this summer back in June. They got new music that we should expect next year. I want to thank you guys, Corey Clifford, Kinsey Ring, Sam Brown, and Ed McMenamin, for coming in tonight and performing. We appreciate it. Thanks, guys. All right. There you go. I sound like Linda from Bob's Burgers right there. All right. I was on, I don't know if you heard this, Pete, but I was on with Cochran on Friday with all the crew.
Yeah.
Andrea, Mary.
Listened to a lot of that show.
So we were talking about Halloween costumes. And I brought up, I said, I think I'm going to go as Tina from Bob's Burgers, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was what I was thinking about going as. And they all go, I don't know. What are you talking about? And I was like, what do you mean, what am I talking about? They're like, I don't know what that is. And I was like, Bob's Burgers on Fox. It's not like I'm talking about an Adult Swim show.
It's on BoJack Horseman.
Yeah, exactly. That was a BoJack Horseman, you know? And the whole team across the board.
Huh. Surprising.
And then Mary, and then Sandberg was like, she said, oh, I know Bob's Burgers. I mean, that's, I think she goes, you're going as Tina, and that's because you're different. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, I feel like that's a pretty well-known show. We've had a lot of the actors on the show.
Yeah.
I feel like that's like kind of a go-to.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it's a mainstream, you know, animated show. It's
I guess
it's
not,
part of the Sunday night
I guess it's
night
not
lineup.
mainstream. Cochran's going to be mainstream in the way that they're like, you know, number one talk WGN. But like that tells you a lot that if the whole crew that's in there that's talking about Dancing with the Stars and all that kind of stuff, they don't know what Bob's Burgers is.
I suppose that the Sunday night animation is not the juggernaut it once was.
Well, that's what I said. I said, it's after The Simpsons. It's between Family Guy and The Simpsons. And they went, oh, it's okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so I can't be bothered with that. So, anyway, so I thought that was weird, though.
Yeah, that is.
You know?
But they don't need to be bothered with stuff like that. Yeah, they have more important things to do. They've got their presidential candidates and whatnot.
That's right.
Well, Tina.
They have senators and governors and mayors. And I'm like, hey, let's talk about Halloween costumes. That's what we do at night. Anyway. All right, so we're off tomorrow night. The Blackhawks and the Red Wings. How great is that? It's a preseason game, so, you know, we don't see the Red Wings that often. I don't know what the breakdown is, how many times you see them per season. It's two, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know how it works, you know, now that they're in the East.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the point being, they're going to be at the United Center tomorrow night. So we're off as the Blackhawks preseason rambles on. So exciting that the season is getting closer and closer to starting. And I was watching a little bit of the Blues, the Hawks Blues on Saturday night. I think it was Saturday night? Friday? Saturday? Anyway, I was like, yeah, bring it back.
You're ready.
I'm already ready. I was like, yeah, I was like, oh, just pick up right where it left off. Like, I just feel like with the Bears kind of being, and the Cubs are great, and I can't wait for the Cubs in the playoffs, but, like, having that Blackhawks kind of energy, I really liked it. Like, I really got jacked up.
Let's get a Blackhawk to come on. Talk Blackhawks every week.
I know one, Javi Havivola, but I don't know what his deal is. We got to get him back on.
Yeah. I'm not sure what his schedule is. He's probably in demand after his performance here.
I noticed from
last year.
His Twitter feed, he was back in Latvia for a good part of the summer, so I don't know if he's back yet, so we'll have to check in.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to check in with him.
We'll have to check in with him. Anyway, that's all coming up this week. So Tuesday we're off. Wednesday night, though, we're back. I've got two great Chicago chefs coming in studio, Jason Hamill, Matthias Merges. Hassan Minhaj,
The
Daily Show correspondent, will be with us Wednesday. We've got a lot of great stuff coming up this week. I'm so excited about it. So lots to do this week in the download, but we won't be on tomorrow night. Special thanks to Bob Ferguson tonight for a great mix on the band Laverne, which is coming up at Empty Bottle October 13th. Like we said, no show tomorrow night, the Blackhawks. But we shall return on Wednesday.